Okay. As I said, my topic has sort of changed as I've been listening to the talks here. My introduction that I was going to have will remain the same. That is, I'm going to discuss some new experiments on structure functions that I have access to. And I will continue this through a tiny bit of discussion. If I had more time, I'd probably give more, but a tiny bit of discussion about what this might have to do with isotropic turbulence. I see similar effects in isotropic turbulence. And from these two discussions, I'm going to come to a conclusion that there could be two dynamically important small length scales in turbulence. And that one would be the Kolmogorov microscale, obviously, but the other would not necessarily be just a multiple of the Kolmogorov microscale, but would depend on Reynolds number in a different way. So that's a conclusion. And then I'm going to sort of shift gears completely and propose discuss a dynamical mechanism involving singularities, which I've talked before to a lot of you. And what I want to show there is that the collapse of Euler must involve two length scales. And my discussion here will also have changed from what I would have originally done, mainly to some conversations I've had with Peter Constantine in the last hour or two. So, yes, this is a dynamically changing system. Now, I think everyone here knows what the Navier-Stokes equation is, but the point I want to emphasize here is that if you take the stress tensor, you decompose it into the strain and the vorticity, and the question that Arkady Sinober discussed in his lecture, which is a nice introduction to a lot of what I might be saying, is that if you look at the strain and the vorticity, if you take these two different views of the elephant, you're going to get different pictures of the structures and the statistics and turbulence. So I want to sort of extend just saying the strain and the vorticity. I want to divide this a little more. Here we have vorticity. The vorticity, maybe you can identify with shear. Things going like this. Shiyi Chen also gave a nice introduction to my talk where he discussed how transverse structure functions like this, W x plus r minus w of x, some order p, that this is going to be associated with shears, so you're having a velocity, so if that's r and w that are perpendicular, that's going to be a experimental signature of something to do with the intermittency and structure of the vorticity, and related to that, you can create a refined similarity hypothesis involving the entropy. I'm just saying that this is one way of getting at something to do with the structure of vorticity. Well, yes, that's quite right. And a large part of our problem here is decomposing these things. But I'm just going to follow the arguments that Shiyi gave the other day, saying that the transverse structure function might have something to do with vorticity. And then on the other hand is the more traditional way of looking at things with the strain. And here we talk about longitudinal structure function. Okay, where U and R are parallel. And of course we have a refined similarity hypothesis there involving epsilon. Okay, so two different ways of looking at turbulence. And the first thing I want to do is show another one of the figures that Shiyi showed, which comes from the paper of Srini's group, extended self-similarity plot of the longitudinal and transverse structure functions with, and I got these colors reversed here, with the there a slight difference of 0.66 between the exponents of these two scaling functions given here on the right. And I've got these mixed up in colors. So, now, 0.6066 is not very big. In fact, the original paper that suggested that this might be important, for example, by Bortoff and Peltz, got a difference here that was more like 0.15 or so, suggesting that as the Reynolds number is going up, maybe this difference between these two exponents is actually getting smaller. But let me ignore that possibility, and let me just make an assumption for the moment that those two structure functions might have, that type of scaling might exist at infinite Reynolds number. Now, a problem with that, if that is what happens, is if you look at the second order pressure structure function, Hill and Wilczek showed that you can construct this out of combination of the fourth order longitudinal structure function and the fourth order transverse velocity structure function plus a mixed structure function. So if this is a linear combination of these two, and you make assumption you have a very long inertial regime to get rid of all the nasty integrals that are in their formula, what you end up with is something like this green curve here, which is going to have a break somewhere in the middle of the inertial range where it's going to have different scaling on either side of that break, saying that there's some length scale in the middle of the inertial range where something changes that is significant. And the traditional assumptions about turbulence theory is that the inertial range is scale invariant, that there should not be any particular length scale in the inertial range that could have dynamical significance. Now, you could say, well, okay, fine, but P's just a derived quantity. Maybe you would expect that to be true. But what's the derived quantity here, and what's the fundamental quantity? Pressures, in our traditional thinking, is something very fundamental. Could it be the fundamental quantity, and actually these be the derived quantities? Either way you look at it, you're talking about something that we have generally believed to be somewhat fundamental that's going to have some sort of break in its scaling in the middle of the inertial range. Now, Mark Nelkin has a similar argument based on spectra using dissipation-dissipation correlation, entropy-entropy correlation functions in here. And he comes up with the following argument that as nu goes to zero, that as we go to infinite Reynolds number and k goes to zero, that unless everything in the brackets here cancels out, we're going to have an infinity here. We're going to have some sort of blow up in the pressure spectrum that just seems unphysical. And the only way for that to be resolved is actually for these exponents, mu, mu omega, mu x, which would be equivalent to exponents presumably associated with the structure functions, they should be equal. But let me make a point that in this formula that this would only be true for k less than this quantity here. That is, if k is greater than this quantity here, which if the spectrum goes as u squared, that is for k greater than 1 over the Taylor microscale, then this term here wouldn't be blowing up, and there would be no restriction on this. That is, you could have a pressure spectrum that is going to be basically background terms for k less than 1 over lambda, which might be the minus 7/3 spectrum that we saw Toshi Goto present earlier. And then for k greater than 1 over lambda, these terms will be important, and we could have a different spectrum that maybe is k to the minus 5/3. So let's go back to this plot here. Now, this was extended self-similarity. There was another plot in that paper which plotted ratios of the transverse structure function to the longitudinal structure function. And the point I want to make here is that in each of these, especially fourth order and sixth order, This type of scaling, where the ratio looks like a very nice power law, breaks down somewhere here at several times the Kolmogorov scale. That is, it looks like there is some breakdown within the inertial range. Now, is that breakdown occurring at just some constant multiple of the Kolmogorov scale so that it becomes more and more concentrated down into small scales as we went to larger and larger Reynolds number, or does this sort of persist in the middle of the inertial range? So, to address that question, I fortunately, finally, got Alexander Preskoski to analyze some of the crosswire probe data that he collected from the Moscow wind tunnel when he was a program director there under the old Soviet Union and had access to the best VAX equipment and best crosswire probes that you could buy in the West, despite what our propaganda said. And what he did is he took the longitudinal and transverse second-order structure functions, and he plotted those for his two experiments, one a mixing layer and one a return channel. The R lambda of these experiments is the order, I think, 2,500 and 3,000. So this is very high R lambda experimental data. And in green arrows I show here the outer limits that people usually define for the inertial range. That is, the largest scale for which the longitudinal structure function here, underlined in red, sort of obeys R to the 2/3 scaling, and the smallest scale, which is believed to be something like 10 or 15 times the Kolmogorov scale, where you get R to the 2/3 scaling. And then he defined, but these experiments contain a huge amount of anisotropy. The large amount of anisotropy results in the fact that when you do the analysis on the transverse structure functions here, they do not obey the 4/3 relation between transverse and longitudinal all the way out to this larger scale, out to this blue arrow here and only out to this red arrow here. So in his further analysis of this, he only considers an inertial range defined by this outer length scale here. And he did a similar thing on the third order structure function. And then he went and did the analysis on the fourth and sixth order longitudinal and transverse structure functions. And what we have plotted here is the logarithmic derivative of these right here. That's what's plotted here, such that what we are looking for scaling that's the same between the longitudinal and transverse structure functions, what we are looking for is that the exponents for the transverse and longitudinal regimes would be the same. And what he found is that in a regime that started at large scales at this outer length scale, where presumably for smaller scales it's isotropic, the anisotropy has been excluded, over a significant range that's within the inertial range, he did get the same scaling exponents for the transverse and longitudinal structure functions. But the other thing he found was that this did not continue all the way down to the smallest length scale that is typically identified with the low end, the small scale end of the inertial range. It only went partway there, up to where these small arrows are. And at that point on, from R smaller than that, there was a breakdown in this type of relationship for all of these cases. Dissipative scale is on the left. Well, no, we're not. He's just plotting. He's taken his data and calculated a logarithmic derivative. He's plotting that. He's not plotting, assuming scaling. He's plotting the logarithmic derivative. And the other thing you might complain about this is that as you get to small scales, this starts getting a little bit noisy. And if I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking, I have access to new 512 cube data from Maurice Meneguzzi that I got a hold of last April, where I've done the same analysis on 512 cube isotropic data, where you don't have to worry about the resolution at the small scale, and you see similar trends, not as strong. There's still a separation between the scaling exponents in 512 cube simulations, but it's going in this direction. So what I'm going to suggest here is that this type of relationship might only go to a length scale that is not something that is just 10 or 15 times the Kolmogorov scale. Here it's more like 50 or 40 or 50 times the Kolmogorov scale. And what we might actually have here is a length scale within the inertial range that is actually dependent on Reynolds number in a different way than the Kolmogorov microscale. Okay, that's my experimental evidence suggesting that there could be two small length scales that are we need to understand in turbulence that are both dynamically significant. No, I do not know the details of this, but one thing Alexander Preskovsky is very careful about is getting good sample sizes. I know this from his analysis of the atmospheric data at NCAR. He's been very, very, very careful. Okay, good. That I'm glad there's someone. Now, let's go to isotropic force turbulence in a box. Now, this is a picture out of a movie. This is pre-video. A movie I made in 1983 when I was a postdoc at NASA Ames. Eric Sigia had produced similar pictures before that. This is just colored of vortex tubes. The thickness of these vortex tubes is roughly the Kolmogorov microscale. At the Reynolds number that I could get at 64 cubed, I saw the length of of these vortex tubes being the order of the size of the box. And that's about all I could say was it was bigger than the Kolmogorov microscale, but how much bigger, I didn't know. Now here is a visualization of the largest Reynolds number calculation that I am personally aware of. A 512 cube calculation by Porter, Pouquet, and Woodward using the PPM method. So this isn't... No, but this is a hyperviscous calculation. Okay, so the Reynolds effective Reynolds number of this might be higher than the 1024 cube. But there's lots of problems with this. I'm just showing this to show the type of fine scale structure that we now can get out of these calculations. This is incompressible, yes. Oh, it's slightly compressible. Very, very slightly compressible. But that's not an issue, we believe. Okay, this is a demonstration of what the latest calculations could give. I mean, if Toshi Goto can produce a similar picture out of 1024 cube, I'd love to see it. Okay, good. I would like to see it when he does it. Okay, but the point here I want to make is you still see the little vortex tubes going through that. Their thickness is something like a dissipation scale, a Kolmogorov scale. And their length, though, is not the length of the box. Their length is some finite multiple of the Kolmogorov microscale. But is that finite length... Well, fine. There are all sorts of problems with this. This is a demonstration of what this might look like. And until someone gives me a 1024 cube, this is what I want to use to demonstrate this. Mark, you can talk about this later. This is just a demonstration of a point that I want to make. The point I want to make here, right, there's a diameter and a length, and we don't know if that length is a multiple of the dissipation scale that's constant, or if that length grows with respect to the diameter as Reynolds number goes up. For scales larger than this length scale, you could basically throw all the vorticity, small scale vorticity, into some statistical ensemble, and then I believe everything that people have been saying about assumptions of Markovianization and everything else with respect to scaling and turbulence could very well work. And it could very well explain why our statistical theory seemed to explain so much of the scaling at the larger scales within the inertial range. And if, though, the small scales are dominated by this, it would explain why so much of our statistical theories of turbulence don't work at the small scales, because we don't know very much about the interactions of these vortices. That's the point I want to make here. So, going back in time again, back to this picture here, which now think of as just a little tiny segment of the one I just showed you. Where did this vortex come from? Well, I actually made a movie of this, and I've actually now digitalized the frames, and one of these days I'll put it on the web so you can all watch it, but I'm not there yet. That vortex, long vortex, actually started out as two lumps of vorticity right here. Now, in yellow here is a measure of the dissipation of that flow. I don't want to get into the details of what that is, but it's a measure of the dissipation. In white is where these overlap. The point I want to make here is where the dissipation is found is where you have lumps of vorticity interacting. It is not around individual vortices that aren't interacting with other vortices. Here's another picture at the same time that's been rotated. And then from that time, it evolves. And I have this on video if anyone wants to see it. It evolves into this here. And what happens is those two lumps of vorticity somehow merge into one that just stretches and stretches and stretches, but the strain, the dissipation that was associated with that interaction actually moves away from it. That the dissipation structures are associated with vorticity, but not individual vortex tubes. They're associated with interactions of vortex tubes. Now, this was back in 1983, and you know, I didn't really come to this understanding of what this movie was saying till a few years later. And this and other calculations, vortex filament calculations by Chorin, Pumir, Sigia, other things, eventually brought us to the conclusion that a good paradigm for understanding the basic interaction between vortices was to consider two anti-parallel vortices. So a number of us, myself, Fazli Hussein, Pumir, Sigia, groups around Ortsag, etc., all started banging away on this problem of two anti-parallel vortices. If you have two anti-parallel vortices in two dimensions, and it's inviscid, they will propagate on forever. But this is three dimensions. If you put a perturbation on it, where the perturbation is greatest, it will stretch out in this direction. It's an incompressible flow. So that stretching will come back and push the vortices together. I took advantage of symmetries in this to only study, I only calculated one corner of this domain, and this is from my original work on this with Fosley, 1989. And here's one quarter of the domain. This vortex, remember, continues through this symmetry plane here, and then there's a mirror image of that symmetry plane on the other side of this dividing plane here. Where the vortex starts smashing together, here I am outlining in blue. It starts smashing down into a sheet-like structure. That you're seeing blown up here. As time goes on, you see a remnant of the original vortex tube meeting this sheet-like structure in some sort of corner here. And then the game became, could this geometry for Euler be leading to a singularity of the Euler equations? That is, Navier-Stokes without viscosity. And in my 1993 paper, I came up with three tests to determine whether this geometry could be yielding a singularity. First test was based on the paper by Bielke and Maida, 1984, making the additional assumption that this is algebraic with some power gamma. BKM 84 implies that gamma has to be greater than or equal to 1. I believe it was Eric Sigia who first suggested to me that I should take gamma equals 1 because that's the dimensional exponent that works. That is 1 over the peak vorticity has units of time. And if this is right, then 1 over the peak vorticity should be linear in time with a prediction of a singular time. You can do the same thing for the strain. 1 over a component of the strain should be linear in time with a prediction of a singular time. And finally, empirically, I found a global quantity. 1 over the integral of the entropy production should be linear in time, and prediction of a singular time. And if those three singular times agree, then I have some evidence that this calculation is showing evidence for a singularity of Euler. Now, this last one here I said is empirical, but what I'm going to get to in the last few minutes of this lecture here is some ideas relating to two small length scales in this problem that could have something to do with why this quantity blows up. So let me just show the evidence that I presented in my 1993 paper. And this essentially was first presented at a seminar here, not in this building, but the old building, of ITP on a workshop on topological fluid dynamics that was organized by Keith Moffitt, Arkady Zimanover, and others. And so here's 1 over the peak vorticity. The mathematicians prefer to call that the L infinity norm of the vorticity, the strain component, and then 1 over this integral quantity. And all three of these quantities are essentially linear at the final stages, all pointing to a common singular time of about 18.7. And that was my evidence in 1993 that this flow is consistent with the singularity of the Euler equations. Excuse me? Gamma. Dimensional analysis. That 1 over vorticity has units of time. That's it. That's it. Period. No. That's it. All the math can tell you is the bound and the limit. And that's just a condition. Doesn't mean that there's anything out there that actually will obey them. Right. But it's a test. It's a useful test. It's a useful guide. Okay. Now here's a fancy picture of what this structure looks like. Again, this is the vortex tube that comes into this region. In dark blue down here is where the peak vorticity is in this corner. That this is an elbow. The vortex is coming around an elbow, and we're taking a slice through that elbow and then half of the arm. Okay? That's the corner of the elbow. And this is the original vortex tube, and it comes out, and there's a huge amount of curvature in this problem. So one thing that's very important if you're going to generate a singularity of the Euler equations is the only way you can do that is if there's an enormous amount of curvature in the problem. Here's 3 pictures, 3 different times, 15, 17, 17.5, where the singular time is predicted to be 18.7 of the collapse of this thing towards some point down here. Now, the point I want to make here is that this collapse is not perfectly self-similar. That you cannot just scale this structure into this structure into this structure with just one shrinking length scale. You just cannot do it like this. There are 2 length scales appearing in these projections, in these slices. There's a length scale associated with the extent of vorticity that is the order of magnitude of the peak vorticity in this corner here. Then there is a second length scale which is associated with a jump in vorticity right here at the leading edge and right down here between the vortex and its anti-symmetric pair on the other side here. There are 2 length scales appearing here. No. Well, looks like I'm doing well on time, so I actually might be able to say something about that. Right. Well, let's get to that, okay? So here is another point I want to make, though. Okay, here's one particular time. Here's that fancy color image now just in black and white, so you can actually see that the peak vorticity is in this corner a little bit better. Here's the vortex structure with 1 front here and 1 front here, so that the length here is much more than the width here. And then here's the strain rate that's actually pulling this thing out. And the strain rate is much more diffuse than the vorticity. And it's not just the simple rescaling of the scales here. I mean, this is concentrated sort of in two vortex sheets meeting in a corner. This is spread out sort of uniformly over this whole thing. For this type of structure, there's absolutely no question that the vorticity will be more intermittent than the strain. And if turbulence was composed of structures like this at the smallest scales, then we could have an explanation of why the scaling exponents of the transverse and longitudinal structure functions were different. Unfortunately, this structure cannot explain turbulence. A view graph that I didn't bring and should have brought is that the energy spectrum that's developing at this time is nothing like k to the minus 5/3. The energy spectrum that's developing is k to the minus 3. So here's a cartoon of the analysis I've done that shows that this outer length scale here collapses as some critical time minus time to the 1/2 power, but this thickness here is going as critical time minus time to the first power. Now, the thing that's changed in the last hour or two is, first of all, I only have one sort of mathematically based explanation at this point for why you need two length scales in the collapse. And this is Peter Constantine's Holder semi-norm argument, which says that if you assume a scaling solution of U that looks like this with an exponent Q and an exponent P for R, and that implies a vorticity that's going to look like this, such that P plus Q is equal to 1, that the only way that you can keep all the energy contained within the collapsing region is if P is equal to 2/5. For it to be exactly self-similar. Well, I've showed you exponents that are greater than 2/5, which means that within this region that's collapsing, the energy has to be escaping. Now, if there are any cosmologists in the audience, they'll know that there's been a recent claim about naked singularities in Einstein's equations for a very funny collapsing solution. But it turned out that what's actually happening was that all the mass, that is all the energy, was escaping from this region through gravitational radiation. Well, there is no gravitational radiation here. There is no waves at all. When it's collapsing, there's no way out but except for there to be a avenue out. In other words, you cannot have things collapsing uniformly in all three directions. You have to have something a little bit more like our traditional vortex, which is going to be thick at the beginning, and then you stretch it out, and it's going to be collapsing in two directions, and going out in a third direction. I'd like to hear more about that, because I'm doing MHD now, too. What I wanted to use was some of the length scales that were coming out of Constantine Pfefferman and Mida. They're based on calculating the strain along the vorticity, which involves this geometric factor here, and you do funny things with that geometric factor, and you can get some length scales out. The only thing that I can see coming out is at this point is that if I define a length scale associated with the gradient of the vorticity direction direct, two ways of defining the gradient of the vorticity direction vector, and that will, just empirically looking at my data, produce the two types of length scales I'm talking about. Neglecting that fact, I came to the conclusion that there are two length scales that could be defined for this collapse. One I call rho, and 1 over rho dt less than infinity would bound any singularity of Euler. Another one, r, which would be something like the radius of curvature of vortex lines, squared dt less than infinity, and then something related to u, sort of an infinite peak value of the velocity, divided by r less than infinity. And therefore, three conditions I would look for to be satisfied if there's going to be a singularity of Euler equivalent beyond the three I've already presented is that there should be some length scale rho that does this, a length scale r that does this, and I sort of showed you a cartoon of this already, and then the velocity peak value should go as 1 over tc minus t to the 1/2. That doesn't mean the kinetic energy blows up. That can't happen. That's conserved. What it does mean is that in some very localized spot, the velocity could become very, very large. How much time do I have? Okay. And here is what I've done here to demonstrate this is I have normalized the peak vorticity by tc minus t, and then I've taken one of these profiles and just marched across it, one of the things that looks like this over here. I'm just marching across these structures for these three times here in three different directions. So this one is marching across in this direction, and if I go on the left side of the position of the peak vorticity here, 0, there's this position, then this position, and finally this position, I have to rescale things by time to the first power, but on the other side, to get things to collapse, I have to rescale by time minus time to the 1/2 power. Now, this isn't a really strong proof, but I'll assure you that I've gone through just about every power law between 1/4 to 2 for these things, you know, in reasonable intervals, and definitely these are the two that work the best. This one is going up this way, and finally, this one at the bottom is going the radius of curvature direction here, like that. And there, I only get scaling with respect to the outer length scale tc minus t to the 1/2 power. So that's the radius of curvature of vortex lines, based that scaling. And if I had time, I would go through an argument that would show that this is all consistent with the velocity blowing up, not in this plane here. There's a good argument why it can't blow up here. But where the velocity does blow up is if you go out in this direction that has the radius of curvature here, the peak in the velocity, so down here is the peak, this is taken through a slice, not exactly at the position of peak vorticity, but the point here is that the peak velocity is going to be out here somewhere, not on the symmetry plane here, that's shown in these three figures here. And that the position of the velocity out here that's becoming the biggest scales with this outer length scale. This is just one structure. I don't have an ensemble. I have this one particular structure. And what could this have to do with turbulence? Well, here's an actual experiment showing reconnection. And what we have here is a vortex hitting a wall, indicated by dye, blue dye hitting red dye at the wall. When it hits the red dye at the wall, it kicks up the red dye. That red dye starts circulating around that original vortex. Do we see any sort of structures like that in homogeneous isotropic turbulence? Well, I mean, there are a few in this picture. If you look carefully, there's a structure here like this that's sort of like that. And maybe that's the connection to turbulence, that you have this very special thing that happens with this very bizarre k to the minus 3 spectrum. And then once you get reconnection, somehow the energy floods the small scales. You got a lot of vortex structures, and things look like turbulence. But that's a big jump. And I haven't done a good calculation like that to demonstrate whether that is actually the case. And so, here's an outline of what I've done in my talk. After this, I tried the math. Okay. Sure. You want to use a transparency so that
if you want to define this.
Yes. Right. And that is completely true. And that is completely true, but it's my understanding that this argument will still place all of these various dissipation length scales at the Kolmogorov scale or smaller. I don't think this argument produces length scales that are in the middle of the inertial range. I didn't expect people to necessarily like my proposal. But, I mean, the thing is, there's a lot of evidence coming out that there's something going on in there. And, this is just, no one's ever taken this possibility seriously, in my opinion. I mean, everyone's just said, oh, this is just multiples of the Kolmogorov scale, or it's different variations of the dissipation scale. I would like people to consider the possibility of dynamical structures within that could emanate from the dissipation regime that don't involve the transfer of energy. What I'm proposing here is not something that will have any significant energy transfer itself. It will just instigate energy transfer. And therefore, I believe it could leave its footprint, some property of the two length scales associated with it that would appear in other ways. But I have no evidence of this. I have no calculation showing that you go from a singularity to fully developed turbulence at reasonably high Reynolds number to show this. I would like to get this type of calculation done and analyzed so we see if this is a possibility or if something else is a possibility. Well, I mean, this is what you told me earlier, and the only things I've seen so far are your second order structure function stuff. You say you're working on the fourth order, and I'd love to see it when it's out. Yes. Yes. Well, what I'm saying, yes. And what I'm saying is that I'm fully right. Right. That's what I'm saying exactly. And the question I'm posing is, what is that length scale? Could it be something that's dependent on Reynolds number and stays within the inertial range, or is it just a large multiple of the Kolmogorov scale? Just to emphasize what he was saying is, here's the 512 cube data, which is better than the Boritov and Peltz data, and here is the fourth order longitudinal and transverse structure functions, and you see the difference is about 0.2, and then as you get into the higher Reynolds number, better statistics of the experiments, this has gone down to about a quarter of that value. Maybe we want to take a break. Did you want to say something? Why don't we do this in the discussion tomorrow? You want to make a... Okay.
But we're not allowed to discuss it until tomorrow.